Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I am your host, Alex Haddix, and this is episode 203, Experience Feeds Training with Daniel Shaw, Part 1. This week, we have the first part of an amazing discussion with Daniel Shaw, a staff sergeant and firearms trainer with the U.S. Marine Corps. Daniel also hosts Gunfighter Cast, just one of the many great podcasts on the Gun Rights Radio Network. Daniel and I spend a lot of time discussing how his combat experiences have changed his personal training techniques and those that he teaches to others. The interview went so long I had to split it into two episodes. This week is part one, and it will blow you away. Before we get to discussion, I want to make the quick announcement that we now have the Practical Defense Tip and Comment Line. Thanks go out to Paul Wilson of Karate Cafe for suggesting a great way to set it up. The number is 805-203-6586. The system will put you right into a voicemail box, and you can leave your tip or comment. I'll start including some of the messages into the show, either in the email section or as quick tips. So the tip and comment line number again is 805-203-6586. And a quick final note. Masoud Ayoub has a new book out, and the Kindle edition just became available. The book is called Combat Shooting with Masoud Ayoub. I already have my copy, and I'm about halfway through it. As with all of Mass's books, this one contains a wealth of information, and it's always worth the purchase price. I highly recommend it. Alrighty, we'll be right back with part one of our discussion with Daniel Shaw.
Hey, this is Paul Wilson of Karate Cafe reminding you to leave a tip or message on the Practical Defense comment line.
The legal aftermath of using a gun in self-defense can be traumatic and expensive. Get help and peace of mind through the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. Network members receive much-needed financial and legal support right after a self-defense incident. They also receive education in the form of DVDs from some of the top names in the business, along with having access to a nationwide pool of attorneys. Learn about membership at www.armcitizensnetwork.com.
I will hit 15 years this coming May.
Wow, that's a long time. Thank you for your service.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And Daniel is also a firearms instructor. He covers pistol, rifle, and shotgun for the Marine Corps. So he's a Marine Corps firearms instructor. And Daniel is with us today from Okinawa, where he's currently stationed. What we're going to talk about is his experiences with combat and how training has affected him. And the most important thing is, how has that changed his training and what training aspects allowed him to survive his encounters? So, welcome, Daniel. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Alex.
So, you've done several tours of duty in combat zones and have been in conflict and combat under fire. Is that right?
Yes, it is. I've been, I didn't really do much, kind of just watched it happen with the bad guys shooting each other. Did a little security operation in Albania back in 98. Did a couple trips to Iraq, the initial invasion, and then OF 2 and 3 in the northern Babel province in, you know, pretty nasty area. That's pretty much it.
Okay. Well, that's a lot and a heck of a lot more than most of the rest of us are going to ever experience.
Well, most of it, I don't wish it on anybody. So that's a good thing.
That's, yes, absolutely. So in terms of your combat experience, how did your training affect what actually went down in the real world?
Well, it affected everything. It wasn't just me. It was, you know, the entire unit. We trained individual skills a lot, but we also train with the unit, with the team, working together, whether you're talking about platoon tactics, squad tactics, or fire team tactics. For a little jargon explanation there, a platoon would be about, should be, if they're plussed up, you know, pull everybody 40 to 60 men. You got three squads. Usually they end up being, the math isn't going to add up here just because of some other things that, for the sake of time, I'm not going to explain. 12-man squads with a squad leader, and a fire team would be 4-man teams, three of those in each squad. You know, sometimes you work together with a fire team, sometimes you work with a squad, sometimes you're with a platoon, sometimes you're doing company tactics. But it all comes back to the individual. You know, is he able to operate by himself? Does he know his job? And if he's in a fire team, does he know the job of that fire team leader? And then he should know the job of that squad leader, because any one of those guys could get whacked at any time, and now he suddenly became a fire team leader or suddenly became a squad leader. So we really focus training a lot on, one, the individual skills, what he is supposed to be doing, but then also two, higher than him, you know, what they're supposed to be doing in those tactics. How it affected us in the fight was, you know, in OF1, we didn't know what to expect. We first went in there. We had heard intel that they were all going to be basically retreating or capitulating. They were going to be, you know, surrendering to us, and we were going to. We had some guys that were in Desert Storm and such, and they were explaining what was going on there, and they said the same thing was going to happen again. And turns out, we ran into a city called Nasiriya, and they were doing the opposite of that. We found ourselves in a pretty nasty situation, and there's a lot of accounts of that fight, and it all comes down to. Basically, they didn't say the higher-ups won this. It was the Lance Corporal. That's the E3 in the Marine Corps. It was the corporals, the sergeants. Those guys won the fight there and got us out of there. And we lost some, but we killed a lot. And we won the fight. It's some of the biggest things that you think about is, you know, how am I going to perform? What am I going to do? What kind of situation are we going to run into? We had no idea whatsoever. So whenever we started taking fire, suddenly, everybody, you know, had been training forever for this, you know, as long as they've been in the Marine Corps. And now we got bullets coming at us and we hear gunfire. And that guy that you think is shouldn't even came, the most worthless guy in your platoon, he's trying to outrun you so he can shoot at a bad guy, too. It's some people say training takes over. You know, I think there's a second there where you're not so sure. But then when you start fighting, it's just kind of like, okay, this is where this fits in. Okay, I know this. I did this before. Okay, got it. You know, I've trained for this, or this is the scenario that we've practiced. We do rehearsals. We rehearse everything over and over again. Just by repetition, there was really no surprises as far as what we should do. There was no sitting and thinking, hey, what kind of action should we take? It was push. And, you know, I really contribute that to the training that we had before we went in there. I know that was kind of one of those tangents, but yeah.
Oh, no, absolutely. No, it's absolutely critical. So a couple things. OF1 is Operation Freedom 1?
Yeah, Operation Iraqi Freedom. That's when we didn't even know it was called that when we went in. But yeah, that was when we initially went across the line and went from Kuwait into Iraq and, you know, started it all off, I guess you could say.
I had a couple of friends in high school that went into the Marine Corps, and then one of their first missions was going into Panama. A lot of them were very close to being fresh out of boot, and they absolutely hated their drill instructor. But he said that you know, as soon as the bullets started flying, the training took over, and it was just an automatic deal. They really didn't have to think. And he said by the end of that, he just wanted to kiss his drill instructor.
Well, you know, the drill instructor is a different thing. They'll teach one thing, and they do some things to prepare you mentally and prepare you, I guess, and physically for it. But as far as tactics, you know, they don't really get into that stuff too much. They get that a little bit later on in some different schools they go to, but they really learn the stuff from the guys like him when he got back from Panama. You know, the new fresh guy just gets into the Marine Corps, and he goes through boot camp, he goes through school of infantry, and now he's out in infantry battalion. He's got an old sergeant there, you know, that's been in the Marine Corps a while, done a couple things. He did into Panama, you know, he was in, you know, somewhere in what they call the Fry over there with Somalia and Albania and the Balkans and all that area, whatever. Those guys that come back, they're like, hey, this is what happens, you know. They're going to be able to explain a little bit more detail about what's important at our level, that platoon, squad, and fire team level, what's important to train for. And if they know they're going to be fighting alongside that guy, if, you know, if something happens, they're going to train that Marine in what they learned was important.
So what you're saying is the training that was most valuable was conducted by people who had been there and had then modified the training, come back and adjusted the training. So,
well, in a sense, yes. A lot of the trainers we had a long lull there where we weren't shooting folks. And, you know, now that we have been doing that again for a while, we've got a lot more stuff coming back, a lot of information, things that are working, things that aren't working, works, gear that we need, gear that, you know, we shouldn't have and they should get rid of, you know, weapons that are better than others, that kind of thing's coming back from the fight all the time. But for a long time there, you know, like I said, we just weren't shooting folks, so we didn't know these things. We were training on basically a lot of what the civilian side was doing, other militaries were doing. They would have symposiums where people who had never really done anything would sit and talk about what they think they should do. But we didn't have that feedback like we used to. You know, the height of the Vietnam War, you know, we had all kind of stuff. You know, there wasn't a lot of support, a lot of money, and a lot of other things without getting into all that. But, you know, this one that we're in now, this is what we call the Long War, because whether anybody realizes it or not, it's not going anywhere. We might pull out of Afghanistan or Iraq, but we're going to have to shoot some Sharia-following person at some point, somewhere again, someday. So that one's not going anywhere. But, you know, it's you might have somebody who's never actually been fired at, you know, have or shot his rifle at anybody else, but he's going to be using feedback from what we call after-action reports. So they'll have these reports from a big fight we got into, or an operation that went down, or something, or just an after-action review on a piece of gear. And we can read those things. We can talk to those people, email them back and forth, ask them questions about, hey, what'd you think about this, or how did this operate? And, you know, people that we talk to in the fight, it's we get good feedback from them. The Marine Corps is a very, very small place. You know, it's we're the biggest we've been, I think, ever right now, and we're cutting down again. But you know, I can email anybody. I know somebody in every unit. If I watch the news or watch something on, and I see a special on the History Channel, there's a staff sergeant or a gunnery sergeant or a master sergeant or something that's on that show that I know. So if I see something going on or hear about something, you know, I'll say, hey, my buddy's over there. I'll shoot him an email, ask him about this. And so now by me talking to them, like, wow, I got that. That was a good tactic, you know, that you guys used there. Can you explain that to me? And then, you know, that's just something else that goes into my toolbox that later on, you know, I could teach somebody else. And having that community that shares knowledge and, you know, shares information stuff, I think you can have a good instructor that's never actually shot anybody, as long as he's humble enough to know that there's guys out there that have shot people and have been shot at and have reacted to that and survived and take their feedback.
So how did your experiences affect the type of training that you give to your fellow Marines?
Well, I used to teach straight out of basically the manual, basically what, you know, I am required to teach, with really no additions to that. Not because there wasn't anything more that we should be taught, but because I didn't know it. So now, before, for example, this past week, I went out and I taught some Navy corpsmen and their officers, naval officers, pistol and M4. And we did a little range, and we shot the pistol, and we shot the rifle a little bit. But before we went out there to shoot, you know, I knew these guys were Navy corpsmen. They don't get behind the gun as much as we do. And
can you explain what a corpsman is, just for the?
Oh, sure. It's Marines. We don't have chaplain. We don't have that, and we also don't have medics. We get all of our doctors and all of our medics from the Navy. We get our preachers and priests and all that from the Navy as well. And so our corpsmen are what the Army would call a medic. And so in an infantry platoon, you would have your whole platoon of Marines, and you would have one Navy corpsman there with you to patch us up if we get hurt. And that's what a corpsman is.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So we were going out there and shooting with these guys, and we got the call last week that they were going to do this training. And I said, hey, do you have a couple of hours the day before so we can get all these guys together? Now, we can go out there and we can just shoot, and they'll get something out of it. But if I can get those guys for a couple of hours the day before, and I'd say guys, but it's a general term, there was females there too. I said, if I can get them a little bit a day before and you know, get them for at least a couple of hours just to teach them some classes and teach them how to set their gear up and stuff like that, it would make it a lot more productive when we got out there and went loud. So they found a couple of hours for us. And so when I get an opportunity like that, I could just teach them the fundamentals of marksmanship. I could just teach them, you know, how to load and unload. And I did all that and basic safety and, you know, clearing stoppages and that. And I went through all that stuff. But one thing that I've learned that's very important is where you place your gear on your body. We wear so much gear right now, it's ridiculous. But where your magazines are on your flag jacket or your plate carrier, whatever you're wearing, where your first aid kit is important, all the way down to the small detail. I tell people all the time, you know, and I ask them in these classes, like, when's the last time you got bit by an elephant? And they always say, haha, that's funny, never. And then I say, when's the last time you got bit by a mosquito? And they're all like, well, yeah, a couple minutes ago, or I'm getting bit right now. You know, so it's the little things that are going to get you. And marksmanship is a lot of little things. Combat at the unit level or an individual level is a lot of small things coming together. Personal protection the same way. Just defending yourself. So one thing I'd talk about is, you know, where you place your gear. I learned, not from me because I wasn't one of these Marines, but in Nazaria we had some Marines trying to get to an aid station because they had a lot of wounded. Their track went down. When I say track, I'm talking about an amphibious assault vehicle. It's what we use that floats on the water, and it also goes on land, and it's got a couple of big guns on top, and it's a tracked vehicle. And we call them Amtraks or AAVs or tracks. Their track got hit by a couple of RPGs after it got hit by some mortars and stuff, and it went down. They had to take a building. They ended up calling it the Alamo, and they stayed there for a few hours until my unit was able to go by and snag them up. There was a lot of Marines that were in the basement, or not the basement, but the bottom floor, and then some went to the top, and they were fighting off a lot of Mujahideen and a Republican Guard that were in the area. And one of the things that were able to keep these guys alive, as simple as it sounds, was our SOP of where we place our magazine, or not our magazine, but our first aid kits. They were able to get into their first aid kits and get into each other's first aid kits and hold pressure dressings on each other's wounds and tie off tourniquets and work on themselves and work on each other while they were literally shooting bad guys trying to come in the door and shooting out windows at people trying to get to their position. There was, you know, talking to these guys, they're like, yeah, I was holding a dressing on so-and-so's neck. And, you know, I was capping a guy through the window, you know, and it's just, that's what we did for hours. And just if they had their magazine, their first aid kits on the right-hand side, and they're trying to fight at the same time, you know, physics says that you just can't reach all the way around there with all your gear on. It's just not possible. So simple little things like that, that's just one example of a lot of small things that I picked up.
When I went through my training, we were assigned and where we were told to keep our kits. Oh boy, it's been so many years. I think it was on the left side of our chest. Now, we were told it was done that way so that everyone knew exactly where they were at all times. Is that what you guys had your kits?
You know, some units that, you know, aren't so much in the know, I guess you could say, or don't really pay attention, they'll put them on their back as if they don't, the big first aid kit, unless, as if we're not always in vehicles anymore, but we're always in a vehicle and sit for a 12-hour convoy with a first aid kit on your back right of your flag jacket. Gets uncomfortable. So they end up moving it, and they'll move it wherever they can put it. But some people do say that. Okay. I hear that all the time, people saying, well, we got to put the first aid kit, all of them in the exact same spot so you know where it's at. You know, I disagree with that. I think it should be in a good spot, and everybody can put it in that same spot. That'd be great. Saying that we're doing it so everybody knows where it's at as soon as they run up to somebody, I think it's kind of ridiculous because, you know, how big is the human body? You know, if it's not right there where I see it, where I'm looking when I'm running up to them, it's obviously going to be on the other side. It's not like I got to run a mile to get to his first aid kit. You know, that's just my way of thinking on it.
Oh yeah. And again, my information is 20 plus years old. So
they're still saying that depending on who you talk to. You know, some people will say that's crazy, but some people, you know, they'll still push that. So it may be old, but it's still coming down.
Oh boy.
But yeah, that's just one of the things, you know, and, you know, I really, what I add to it is, you know, the how important it is, you know, the speed versus accuracy debate, you know, how important it is to be both, how important it is to train on your own. You know, you're only going to get a certain amount of ammunition a year as a unit, and then you're only going to get to go to the range so much to go shoot. It's not going to happen very much. I try to explain to these Marines how important it is to train on their own. If that means go draw the weapon out of the armory, clean it real quick because it's time to clean the weapons, put a sticker on a wall, put a little mark with a paint pen or a marker on a wall, and practice presentation, practice going from the alert, that's where you just kind of weapons kind of hanging down in front of you, you're on the sling, maybe you're just letting it hang there from your 3-point sling, practice presenting to the target, putting it on fire as you present, putting sights on target, pulling the trigger, whether it's dry firing or you're on the range live fire, you got to practice. You're not going to be fast at it when you're coming in that door. And you see that guy standing there with the AK pointing right at that door. He knows a Marine's coming in there. And you're coming in and you're at the alert or you're at the ready. And you're already way behind the power curve. This guy's got slack out of the trigger. He's got his weapon on fire. He's got his sights on that door. you got to be quick. You got to be fast, or you're going to get shot. So I really push that. You know, practice on your own. As simple as they'll think, oh, I did that before. You know, presentation, that's easy. It's not, because you present enough times and you pull that trigger enough times, you're eventually going to run out of ammunition. Once that happens, you got to be freaking awesome at reloading. You got to be a reloading ninja. You got to be amazing at it. And if you're not, you're going to find that same guy with the AK. You're going to get a click, or you're going to get a last shot, boom, bolt locks to the rear, and now you got to change a magazine. You know, it's you've got to be fast at that. You got to do that 1,000 gazillion times. And then you got stoppages. You know, we don't want stoppages to happen. Keep your gun clean. But if it does happen, you got to be fast at cleaning that. You know, and that's those are the things I push, you know, a lot, is presentation and reloads. I push those a heck of a lot.
Now, is that because of what you experienced and what you saw, or was that part of the original manual?
Well, I never experienced a stoppage myself, but I did have to do quite a few reloads. I never had to reload in that scenario that I gave, where I just took a shot at someone and now they're getting ready to you know, they're really close to me and they're going to hit me. I had cover whenever I was reloading, but never been faced with that face-to-face, nowhere to go. Can I reload faster than this guy can shoot me? I haven't had that, but I know people who have, and I've talked to them. From the fear that I got and the excitement and that, you know, what I talk about in Gunfighter Cast, sometimes the combat cocktail, when I that feeling that I had, the adrenaline through my body in the fights that I was in, you know, I can only imagine how horrifying it would be to be facing that and then having to conduct a reload. So, you know, we got to get bullets on bad guys, and now your gun's empty. That would just, you think, you know, you're fast at reloading because you're shooting 90 PA, or you think you're fast at reloading because you're doing it in front of the mirror. Wait till your heart is beating out of your body armor, you know, and then you got to conduct that reload. It's you want to be awesome at it, you know, and in peace. So then whenever you're actually having those feelings going on in your body and you're under that extreme stress, you can do it, at least fumble your way through it somehow, somewhat fast.
Let's talk about like that combat cocktail. Shaky hands, jittery, not being able to feel your fingers, these types of things. How much of that impacted the crisis situation?
Well, it's, you know, I don't really remember not being able to feel my fingers or anything like that. I do always wear gloves, and I always tell Marines, you can't gunfight without cool sunglasses and you can't gunfight without gloves on. So I always tell them to get those two things if they don't have them already.
Okay, now why is that? I got to know about the cool sunglasses and gloves.
Well, number one, you just got to look cool. All right, that's very important. If you know, like, you guys who do the martial arts, the guys that go out and they do these funky kicks and, you know, something or other, and they just don't look cool doing it. You know, you can just look at that guy and say, wow, he doesn't know what he's doing. Because if you do it right, it's gonna look cool. And so that's part of doing things right. You know, doing a reload the right way, even loading the weapon properly looks cool. You know, slinging your weapon looks cool if you do it right. I can look at someone handling a weapon for 5 seconds, and I can tell if they're trained or untrained. It's that easy. Just by, do they look cool? No, they don't look cool. That guy needs some work. Let me call him over and help him out a little bit. And it's that kind of thing. But the cool sunglasses, you know, when you look cool, and you got to protect your eyes. You know, it's you always got to protect your eyes. A lot of little things. We fight in a dusty desert environment. 30 seconds into every gunfight, you can't see anything. If the wind's blowing, all that dust is coming back in your eyes. It's or you're in a prone position, or even in a kneeling, and you're firing, and your muzzle blast kicks up a lot of dust and dirt. If you're near some kind of other object, as that stuff comes apart, if you have wind blowing out there, that stuff's coming back in your face. You can't shoot somebody when you got a bunch of dirt in your eyes, basically. And the gloves, you'll be more violent with the weapon. You know, I see people just kind of messing around loading and doing a tap rack bang when they have a stoppage and a failure to fire, and they just tap the bottom of the magazine and then gently rack the charging handle back. You know, that gun likes it rough. You know, it wants you to manhandle it a little bit. So you're not going to worry about cutting your hands up or anything if you got a nice pair of gloves on. And just, you know, who out there does it feel a little bit tougher when they're wearing a nice pair of gloves, you know, nice tight gloves? Everybody feels a little bit more tough. So it's a confidence booster, I think, too. I got my cool sunglasses because you see the cool guys on TV wearing cool sunglasses and shooting people, and I got my gloves on. So now I'm a little bit more confident, and I look cool. So you're ready to fight right then.
Okay, excellent. Because when I The only time I ever wear gloves when I'm out hunting is when I'm duck hunting, because it's usually so damn cold and I'm up to my nipples in frozen pond water. And but my trigger hand, I always go without the glove, and you know, within 10 minutes I'm numb. But the left hand to hold the grip of the shotgun, that's always covered up. So I've always found it to be cumbersome. But I guess you guys are wearing a different type of equipment. Is it like a thin Kevlar?
Oh, well, it depends. I like Wiley X gloves myself. There's a few different types that they make, but they're really tight leather that stay really tight to your fingers, and you don't even notice you're wearing a glove. When it's cold outside and I've got to wear a little bit thicker gloves, I hate that. Can't stand it. But in most times when we're doing that, we've got a few different gloves. A lot of times I'll go light gloves and just wear a glove liner underneath them and wear those flight gloves. Or if I, depending on, you know, I guess how much money I have in my pocket right then, because I go through gloves pretty quick. But the Wiley X gloves have held up longer than any other glove I've ever had. That's why I like them so much. But they're really tight to my fingers and I can't really throw a liner underneath them. I might have to get me a pair of those with a bigger size one of these days. But they're like $60 a pop. Yeah, it's yeah, when it's cold outside, especially if you're riding on a convoy, and a lot of times in OIF 2 and 3, I was on a 7-ton full of infantrymen, and if we got IED'd or, you know, we saw something bad going down or we got ambushed or whatever, they were the assault element. We would basically get out of the vehicle and go assault the objective, whoever the bad guy was, or wherever we thought the trigger man of the IED was at. We would go hit that area and clear it and look for, you know, IED detonation paraphernalia or bad guys or whatever. And I was behind a 240 on that 7-ton. That's a 240 Gulf at the time. Now we're using 240 Bravos. I guess that's a non-important thing. You're sitting in a turret of a 7-ton, and believe it or not, it gets cold in Iraq in the wintertime. And we'd be just freezing riding down the road. And in that case, you know, I had a couple of pair of gloves on, and my hands were still freezing. So there is a time when you got to go with the big gloves. But, yeah, they're cumbersome to me, too. Just kind of a necessity when you're 12 hours in a turret.
Yeah. People don't understand that in a desert, they think it's hot all the time. And it does get really damn hot, but it gets just as cold as it does hot. I had some people very close to me serve in Desert Storm and Desert Shield, and most of the complaints I heard in terms of conditions was cold, 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 cold.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. You know, and I'm telling you, in the wintertime, it was chilly. And there's ice a little bit, you know, in some areas. If you had a little bit of moisture coming down in the morning, there wasn't a whole lot of rain a lot of times, but a lot of times you'd have a lot of morning dew and that kind of thing. But it was pretty miserable for a few months there.
Let's talk about mental aspect. What sort of mental conditioning kept you focused? Basically, you know, it kept you from losing your stuff.
I think that's one of the most important classes that I have. So whenever I have a chance, I try to teach people, if I'm going to go train some Marines and they want to go do shooting, you know, I'm like, hey, I'm going to throw in this class right here, this combat mindset. And I'll talk about combat mindset a little bit with them because this really helped me. You know, I found myself, I had never actually shot at anybody. I had seen people shooting at each other from a couple clicks away on a mountainside when I was watching down into a city. I was the closest I'd ever actually been to this kind of combat. And now I found myself riding in a Nazaria, and we had got the call that the 507 maintenance convoy, you may be familiar with, you know, Jessica Lynch, whenever her convoy got hit. I was with 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines, Team Tank. We were basically a platoon of infantry hanging out with a bunch of tanks, and we rolled over there to the 507. We were the first ones on the scene with them and help clean up that mess and all the bad guys that were attacking them. And just before we got to them, we were taking fire from a couple of buildings. So tanks were pushing up, and tanks are scared to death of infantry. I don't know if anybody knows that, but infantry kills tanks. Tanks are fearless, and except for they're scared to death of infantry. We had to go take out these buildings and see if there's, you know, bad guys in there we were taking fire from. So obviously we were either going to go clear them, and I have a little saying, and I can't say I made it up. I got it from somebody else, but you never send a Marine where you can send a rocket. So we were taking fire from these buildings, and I had my comm helmet on. I'm sitting in the AAV, and the platoon commander says, Shaw, I need you to get out. There's a vehicle building to the left. Get out of the vehicle. Ramp's going to come down. I want you and your gunner to jump out and put a rocket in this building. as we're taking fire from it. I couldn't see this building. There's no windows in this thing on the inside. And I couldn't see this building at all. I didn't know anything about it. So he said, just come down the ramp and turn to your left. You're going to see it. Put a rocket in it. I was like, got it. So I told a couple Marines they're going to come out with security with me and, you know, clear the general area, you know, the sides and everything to watch my back because we're going to be focused on this building and to stay out of the back blast of the rocket. You know, the back blast would be whenever the rocket takes off, the motors burn. There's only one explosion in a rocket. There's not multiple motors in there. So it's going to explode out of the tube, and it's going to use that same velocity to hit that building, vice what a missile would normally do in most cases. So there's a back blast that comes out that can hurt people out to basically 100 meters in a cone shape. So I told him to stay about behind or away from that. And I was scared to death at this point. We're all kind of standed up, stacked up at this at the ramp that's about to come down. And it's kind of a slow ramp unless you just combat drop it. And we didn't have any reason to combat drop it. So it was going to come down kind of slow. So I fought my way to get to the front to get right to that ramp there. And I'm scared to death. You know, I haven't been in a situation before. I knew I was going to step out here and, you know, have to shoot and somebody's going to be shooting at me. So what was going through my mind right then was, man, if I'm this scared, you know, and I've been training a lot longer than the rest of these guys, I've been in the Marine Corps a lot longer than these guys have got to be scared to death right now. So I put on a different little face and tried to act like I was ready to go kill some folks and stuff and act crazy, and I got them a little fired up and stuff, and, you know, a ramp starts coming down. And, you know, it was all like false motivation. It was all fake because I was scared to death, but, you know, I trying to get these guys going, and they were just yelling and stuff, ready to get out the vehicle. Ramp hits the ground. We start running off, and I'm thinking, as soon as I take this step, I'm going to step out here in the light, and I'm going to take a shot, and I'm going to see my guts come out in front of me. Now, that's what we call precognition. It's not like the precog where I can see the future. It's where I'm making up a future that's going to happen. And that stuff will kill you mentally. And I started doing it. I started thinking, as soon as I step out here, I'm going to get hit. So then I started to have second thoughts about stepping off the track. So I'm like, what are you doing, dude? I'm telling myself this. I'm like, this is not going to happen. You're going to get off this track, and you're going to shoot some dude in the face, and it's going to be all right. You're going to do your thing. And but I was having that precog, and I recognized that it was what I had heard about, what I had learned about in class before. I need to put that stuff to the side and not think like that. You know, I'm thinking more offensively and not defensively. So ramp comes down. We come off. Somebody ends up whacking the guy in the building. We didn't even fire a rocket. So we just got back in the track. But I do remember one thing. As soon as that ramp was coming down and I was the first guy getting ready to hit it, there was a step that I had to take to get to that. To the first step is that the ramp gave me room to take a step. And I was scared to take that first step. But as soon as I took it, like, I didn't have that feeling again all day long. And we fought pretty much all day. We were getting in the track, moving somewhere else, fighting. Get back in the track, move somewhere else, fighting again. And that's the only time I remember having that feeling at all. It was just before that first step. And then after I took that step, it was just, you know, game on.
I'm stunned. How do you train and teach other people to overcome what you experienced that first time?
You know what? The Marine Corps does an awesome job with that. You know, people have said that we have a propaganda machine equal to Joseph Stalin. That may be true. People have called Marines extremists. That's probably true too. It's we have a, basically, if you don't step off of that track like I did, you are letting every single Marine in history down. You're letting your country down. All your brothers that are in that track with you, sweating with you, being scared with you, you're letting all them down. You're just a worthless guy who doesn't rate to wear our equal of an anchor. You know, we don't come out and say that basically, but everything else that we teach, we hit history really hard, and what the Marines before us have done, and the Marine Corps that they have left us, and how we should treat it, and how we should, you know, leave the future Marines, the Marine Corps, whenever we leave the Marine Corps. And it's we have a serious propaganda machine, and I don't say that in a negative way. I think it's a great thing, but we teach the Marines, you got to, they want to do it. It's not when you're sitting there training some Marines and we're talking about, you know, presenting to a target like I talked about a minute ago. Yeah, they're bored. You got to wake some of them up every once in a while. You know, they stayed up late playing video games the night before, or they were on Facebook with their girlfriend or something. But it's that's what we run into. But as soon as you start talking about killing folks, or you start talking about shooting people in the face, eyes light up. People start getting excited. You know, they start cheering a little bit. They want to. Marines join the Marine Corps for a certain reason. I think it's a special person that joins the Marine Corps. It's I don't get into the whole, you know, Army sucks, Air Force is, you know, this and that. I don't do that. I don't buy into all that. I think we all have our things that we do, our missions that we do, and we do them well. But I think the Marine Corps itself, there's a certain, I guess, prestige that goes along with our recruit training. And maybe that's due to some movies or some other propaganda or something. I don't know. But, you know, it's you got a lot to live for. You got a lot to fight for. And that's what we instill in the young Marines. And they all want to run to the fight. Like I said at the beginning, that guy that you didn't think was you should take to the fight, you know, he's trying to outrun you now. People surprise you. And but we, you know, we kick that whole thing from the day when they get to recruit training till every day they wake up. You know, we do that. It's all about, you know, the Marine Corps. It's all about, you know, God, country, and Corps. That's it.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zoom Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
Welcome back. Thanks again to Daniel for coming on the show and sharing his experiences with us. Also, the timing for the interview was a bit of a challenge. Because he's in Okinawa and I'm in California, Daniel was up after midnight and I was up before dawn to do the recording. And remember, we're not done with Daniel yet. We'll have the second part of our discussion in our next full episode. The goodness continues. But that will do it for this week. And as always, you can follow my daily tips on Twitter and Facebook. On Twitter, I'm Practical Def. And Facebook is Practical Defense. I also invite you to check out my book on practical home security. It's currently available in DeadTree, commonly known as paperback, Kindle, Nook, and iTunes editions. Autographed copies are available on my website. The URL is alexhaddix.com/book. If you have any tips you'd like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you would like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexhaddix.com. You can also leave us a voicemail on the new Practical Defense tip and comment line at 805-203-6586. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe.
Hey everybody, we are
Lady Antebellum.
Before every show, we practice. Gotta be prepared.
Exactly. And the American Red Cross wants us to be prepared too. Prepared for disaster. This
world. Just take 3 steps to be Red Cross ready. Create a disaster supplies kit with water, food, and a first aid kit. Make a family communication plan and listen to local radio and TV reports to stay informed.
It's that simple. To learn more, visit redcross.org or contact your local Red Cross chapter today. Thank you so much.
You can now hear Gun Rights Radio Network while you're on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. On-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, and no memory or storage wasted. Available for your iPhone, Android phones, or your BlackBerry. Downloading is easy. Go to Stitcher.com or check out your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Gun Rights Radio Network shows can be found under Sources.
Practical Defense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense podcast. For questions, commentary, and topic suggestions, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com.